Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you. It's Tuesday, August the 18th. Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, South Sudan's President Salva Kiir fails to sign a peace deal in Addis Ababa, but his rival, rebel leader Riek Machar, does sign it.
Since we don't have reservation on the ceasefire, we have no reason to continue fighting. We will tell our troops to hold down, stay in their places and observe what we have signed.
And Malawians are divided over a cabinet reshuffle announced by President Mutharika.
I feel like this kind of changes will bring maybe progress in those departments.
The president has not done well. Instead of supporting them, he has decided to remove them. This is not good and he should stop.
It's good for the president to shuffle the ministries.
Those stories and more in the next 25 minutes. Stay tuned.
Top story.
On Monday, Sudan's President Salva Kiir refused to sign a peace deal brokered by regional mediators, saying he needed more time to study it. The pact was, however, signed by rebel leader Riek Machar and Pagan Amum, a former political detainee. Details of the deal remain unclear. The agreement, signed in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa, was meant to end months of fighting which have killed tens of thousands and displaced more than 2 million people. Coletta Wanjui has been following the talks in Addis Ababa and sends us this report.
The road towards comprehensive peace in South Sudan has begun with the signing of an initial agreement between the rebel faction led by Riek Machar and the leader of the former political detainees of South Sudan, Pagan Amum. Amum is also the Secretary General of the ruling SPLM party. President Salva Kiir, though present, failed to sign the agreement, claiming he still needs to consult further on some underlying issues, particularly matters that deal with the power-sharing arrangement. Kiir's government is unhappy with some parts of the deal, saying it has allocated a lot of power to the rebel faction. He said he needs 2 more weeks to look carefully into it before returning to sign it in Addis Ababa. Rebel leader Riek Machar, who signed the pact, says for now he will respect the ceasefire as part of the deal.
We don't have any reservations on the ceasefire. And therefore, since we don't have reservation on the ceasefire, we have no reason to continue fighting. What we'll do is we'll tell our troops to hold down, stay in their places, and observe what we have signed.
IGAD heads of state, who for the past few days have been meeting President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Machar, have warned that this delay by Kiir should not be an excuse for war to go on. President Uhuru Kenyatta, who has been in Addis Ababa for the last 4 days consulting on this conflict with other presidents, says this should be the beginning of the walk to peace for the suffering South Sudanese citizens.
We're all here, not just for the people in this room, but for the millions of South Sudanese who are looking out in hope that at least, if nothing else, and even if there are still some details to be worked out, they will have peace. They will have peace. They will know that they are safe. They will know that they can access humanitarian assistance.
The agreement offers a 3-month window period before the formation of a transitional government of national unity. The rebel faction says it will wait for the government to honor the agreement and then move on towards ending the 20-month-old civil war. For now, the speed at which the guns will go silent in South Sudan is highly dependent on whether the government goes ahead with the signing in a fortnight.
Coletta Wanjui reporting. To try and understand what the agreement could mean for South Sudan's future, I've been talking to Peter Schumann, former UN coordinator in South Sudan.
It's very difficult to speculate because, you know, basically we have two agreements in front of us, the Kampala formula and the Addis formula, and I see major political differences in both, which also reflects the conflicting interests from regional actors. Uganda does not want to agree on a demilitarized Juba. As you know, the other actors from IGAD and IGAD Plus have different views. I personally don't see a compromise between these positions. I think it's much more sort of an either or. Either they sign the agreement as originally the text from the 24th of July from Addis, or, which I don't think, Riek Machar will not agree to the Kampala formula. So I don't think we have an agreement.
Which of those two drafts would be the more likely to stick?
The most likely to stick is, of course, the Addis text, because it has more ingredients. Well, one could say, well, under the assumption that the IGAD, and in particular the IGAD Plus participants, will really seriously consider to guarantee compliance with the agreement, then this formula will have a much better future. But this is another major element which I see in this whole process. None of the IGAD and IGAD Plus actors are really willing to put political capital on the table and say, we will heavily interfere politically if the agreement, whatever it is, signed, will be violated.
What shape or form could that political capital take?
A very clear indication that in case a party violates, an automatism must take place, starting with sanctions, starting with other possibilities. But, you know, this should have been discussed while these formulas were developed.
President Kiir said earlier he had been compelled to join the talks and warned it would not be possible to sign an effective deal because the rebel forces have split. That's not really the language of compromise, is it?
Absolutely. But, you know, then we have to see the entire picture. Salva Kiir has dismissed 4 elected state governors. Now, it seems that even within the SPLM, within the Salva Kiir's government, there is not a unity on how to approach the entire peace process. Riek Machar has problems with some of his military leaders. Salva Kiir has problems with some of his governors. And I see a major problem coming up, in particular, was the dismissal of these 2 governors from Western and Central Equatoria, because the Equatorians have taken a very clear political position that they are not sort of subscribing to any kind of agreement.
How high will the price of failure be for the mediators if this deal, assuming it's signed, falls apart?
I think the mediators, they will simply blame Riek Machar and Salva Kiir and say, well, we have tried. I think the political price for failure is not high enough for the mediators.
Peter Schumann, former UN coordinator in South Sudan.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
In the South African Parliament, the opposition Democratic Alliance is seeking to impeach President Jacob Zuma. The DA is challenging Zuma's leadership over the events leading up to the departure of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir from South Africa after an AU summit in June. Despite a South African court order, Bashir, who is wanted by the ICC for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur, was allowed to leave the country and return to Sudan. The opposition argues that Zuma's government has defied the courts, hence the need for his removal. But as our correspondent Tuzo Kamalo explains, the impeachment motion has little chance of succeeding.
It is still not very clear if it will make it to parliament, because the ANC has the majority in parliament. Usually what the ruling party says goes, because it is put to vote and is usually struck down. But the impeachment itself, it will be also a hackle for the DA, even if it goes ahead, because what happens is when the motion is adopted, then one third should vote for it. And after that, you need to have an ad hoc committee that will look into the impeachment and look into whether Zuma should be impeached or not. So it is quite a hackle.
But this is also not the first time that the Democratic Alliance has tried to impeach President Zuma. They've been gaining popularity bit by bit over the years. What is different this time?
The DA has quite a number in parliament. They've got about 88 parliamentarians, but still that does not draw the majority of parliamentarians, considering that South African parliament has about 400 members inside parliament. And you have got the EFF that has about 25 members, but the EFF does not agree that an African president should have been arrested in an African event. They're saying that was not supposed to happen. They agree with the ANC, at least in principle, on that one. So even if DA has quite a number, it will need a number from the opposition parties also to support it. But at this point in time, it's not clear if the EFF will support them on this one. The DA, of course, has the support. Quite a lot of people support it because it stands quite clear on corruption as far as Nkandla is concerned, and as far as the other issues of corruption in the government are concerned. But still, it's being branded a white party, and it still commands quite a lot from the white people and a few middle class people. And that number is not good enough when compared to the ANC, of course.
And what about the ruling ANC? Are there some members within the ruling party that would like to see Zuma, maybe even secretly, out of power?
Within the ANC, obviously, if they are there, they are few, and if they are there, they are still underground. But what you should understand is that most of them, they are being in government, they are being in parliament, mostly depends on the presidents of Zuma himself, because he's their boss at the moment. So I don't see a situation where they impeach Zuma. That will embarrass their party. That could lead to a scenario where people distrust the ANC and it lose the majority. So we don't see any chance of them standing up and voting against Zuma in this impeachment if it goes ahead.
That was Tuzo Kamalo in Johannesburg talking there to Crispin Mwakideo.
Africa on the move.
In Africa, many people are dying of curable diseases because they cannot afford treatment. Some think traditional herbal medicine could be part of the solution. Valentin Agon is the brains behind API Benin, a pharmaceutical company that is processing and packaging local herbs. This report by Emmanuel Akpenan and Alexa Meyer is read now by Jane Ayeko.
With every turn of your eyes, green thickets await you, fresh, natural, and full of life. Benin is a country with a great variety of herbal plants. Some of these are what API Benin uses for medical purposes. For fear of being copied, the company does not reveal its exact recipes. Valentin Agon launched the green medicine in Benin 25 years ago. His pride and joy is the remedy against malaria. He has won several awards, which neatly look down from the walls of his office.
In Africa, 3,000 children die from malaria every day. As a researcher, you cannot close your eyes and wait for the solutions to come from elsewhere. That is why we have decided to fight against this disease ourselves. And it is with herbs that our parents and ancestors have used to date.
API Benin produces over 50 herbal medicines. The knowledge to do this comes from the producers' ancestors who practice traditional healing. The malaria treatment, known as API Palu, also has its roots in traditional medicine, explains product manager Francois Ditan.
For us, it's great to experience this moment in Africa, especially in Benin. We are now able to produce effective drugs. They are a local African response to local African problems.
So far, API Palu is an approved treatment for malaria in 5 countries in West and Central Africa. In 2014, the company earned 5 million CFA franc, which is approximately 760,000 euro. Thanks to its exports, more than 300 employees now work for the company. The company, however, faces the challenge of poor infrastructure. For instance, during the rainy season, the trucks that deliver API Benin's drugs regularly get stuck in the muddy, unpaved Maram roads in the countryside. The roads only improve some 100 kilometers from the commercial capital of Cotonou. Despite this, the company is steadfast on its production and distribution. The API drugs are currently sold nationwide in the company's 300 pharmacies. The capsules against malaria are purely herbal, and unlike conventional drugs, they have no side effects, claims Agon.
Our costs are €1.50. Their costs are €10. This is the difference. And another is, of course, that we are close to nature. We represent nature, while they represent molecules and chemical synthesis. Nowadays, people want natural plants.
The people of Cotonou happily buy these products, he says, because in addition to the effect, the price plays a decisive factor.
And that report was written by Emmanuel Akpenen and Alexa Meyer. You're listening to Africa Link, coming to you from Deutsche Welle in Bonn, Germany. To Malawi next, where President Peter Mutharika has reshuffled his cabinet. It is the second time that he has done this since the tripartite elections in May 2014. I asked our correspondent in Blantyre, George Mahango, who were the winners and who were the losers in these latest changes.
One, the loser is Tarcisia Sigoelo, who was the minister responsible for local government and rural development. Secondly, Paul Chibingu, who was the minister of lands, housing and urban development. These two are the major losers. Why? Because they did hold senior cabinet ministerial positions. And by their removal, definitely, it's all pointing to the fact that maybe they were not bona fide members of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party. As for the winners, this one is Peter Kampalule, and he is the Minister of Health. He's just very newly introduced. And the second one is one Malison Ndau, who will be deputizing President Peter Mutharika in the ministerial position of the Defense, because Mutharika is also the Minister of Defense. So the two are the winners, and the first two are the losers in this cabinet, despite the fact that this is a major shake-up, because Jeanne Kaliran, who was the Minister of Health, has now been posted to the Minister of Home Affairs, while Atupele Muluzi, son to former President Bakili Muluzi, who was the Home Affairs Minister, is now the Minister of Lands, Housing and Urban Development. To some extent, it's like a promotion because quite a number of critics did blame Peter Mutharika for including the son of former President Atupele Muluzi into his cabinet.
Does the Cashgate scandal have anything to do with this reshuffle?
Currently, if we look at the ground, there isn't anything to do with the Cashgate, because all the people that have been dropped currently are definitely these people were not part and parcel of the former regime of President Joyce Banda, which a number of commentators say or are blaming for the Cashgate plunders between April 2013 and September 2013.
How have Malawians been reacting to this reshuffle?
Malawians definitely are divided. At the same time, they are hailing this cabinet reshuffle and the firing, because one of the critical reasons that people are giving is that there was some kind of security lapse in the Ministry of Home Affairs, because people were being robbed, even the police officers being killed, government senior officials being robbed, and people in rural areas or in villages, in townships, were not at liberty to transact their businesses for fear of the armed robbers or killings. And one notable issue is the incident in which some notable four police officers were killed recently as they were trying to, chase or run after the robbers. And this is what people that I've spoken to this morning have said.
There were some other positions that were not moving on well. So I feel like this kind of changes will bring maybe progress in those departments. To be specific, the Ministry of Security. This ministry wasn't working on well, because you can see security in Malawi wasn't okay.
The president has not done well. Instead of supporting them, he has decided to remove them. This is not good and he should stop. He should be in the position of supporting them and correcting them where they are failing.
It's good for the president to shuffle the ministries, because I think it makes them at least work hard in fear of being removed or being demoted.
A sample of public opinion in Malawi following the cabinet reshuffle announced by President Mutharika. And earlier, I was talking to our correspondent in Blantyre, George Mahanga.
Making a difference.
And making a difference this week takes us to Bafut Village in northwest Cameroon. This is no ordinary village. It's an eco village and the only one in the country. The idea came from Joshua Kankonko. The former government worker turned farmer believes that Africa can achieve food security through sustainable organic farming. And while still respecting traditional beliefs, such as a ban on felling certain trees or hunting certain animals. Moki Kinseko reports.
I have my talent to show the world. What is our talent to show the world?
A group of women proudly raised their voices in song as they welcomed the initiator of Eco Village, a project designed by John Kankonko to benefit locals from the better management of soil and environmental resources. Buoyant croplands, houses constructed entirely with local material, as well as what the women now call the kitchen revolution, are just some of the things they point to with pride. They are implementing permaculture, a farming system that is not only sustainable, it also builds on the culture of the people. John Kankonko coordinates the project.
This is the way our parents used to farm. When I grew up, we used a pit latrine. And after the latrine was full, we put a plantain there. And the plantain produced and it kept on producing because of the stock of compost that was inside that hole.
Pressures on scarce fertile lands in Cameroon's northwest region have historically fueled tribal conflicts. Permaculture sets out to replenish the soil and maximize yields on relatively small plots of land. The project administrator, Sonita Mbane, says the first step is to hold the soil in place.
We have mechanical erosion control and a natural erosion control. Natural erosion control is done with vetiver grass. You put two plants together and they form a web. And when they form a web, they hold the water and the soil together. For mechanical erosion control, you can use plank and then we use bamboos, just what we have available, and we put a few barriers.
She explains that once anti-erosion methods are in place, they enrich the soil with nutrients.
Inorganic fertilizers destroy the soil family and the soil nutrients.
Farmer Justina Lum says within 2 years, her yields have doubled. She says even at home, she uses improved traditional methods to cook.
This one is nice because wind don't blow the fire.
This one is nice because it is made for combustion and my pot doesn't get black. In addition, smoke is channeled through a chimney and therefore our eyes are not exposed to smoke. Besides, it economizes wood and is not costly to build.
Don't spend so money to build it.
The project that is gaining in importance across northwest Cameroon is the result of Kankonko's upbringing as a child. He says he saw his mother use compost manure to fertilize her crops and learned gardening in school. Those lessons stuck to him even as he walked the corridors of higher learning.
That report was by Moki Kinseka. Before we leave, a reminder of our main stories. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir says he needs 2 more weeks before he is prepared to sign a peace deal. South Africa's opposition party, Democratic Alliance, is seeking to impeach President Zuma. And in Malawi, President Mutharika has reshuffled his cabinet for the second time since taking office in 2014. We welcome your comments on this programme, either in a text message to country code 49 160 957 59510 and email to feedback.africa@dw.com or a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. From me, Mark Caldwell, thank you for listening and bye now.